It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says country music artists could have a big role in gun control conversations after the mass shooting in Las Vegas. First, the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents met throughout the week to vote on resolutions ranging from ways to streamline the hiring process of system leadership to allowing more regent oversight of chancellor recruitment. But one of the more controversial items voted on this week was a new resolution that would allow schools to punish students if they disrupt speakers brought to campus. Supporters have argued that the measure would help bring speakers from a variety of perspectives onto campuses. Opponents have said it could punish free speech rights of protesters. Rich Kramer joins us now. He's a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire. He's been covering the Regents meeting. Rich, welcome back.
Hey, great to be here.
We'll lay out for us what this resolution would do.
Basically, this resolution reaffirms the university's commitment to free speech, but the thing that is getting most attention are the provisions that would punish students. It sanctions students with suspension and possible expulsion for disrupting freedom of expression or free speech at three consecutive times.
And one question that's come up is, what is meant by disruption? How do they define that?
Well, basically, any kind of violence or any kind of shouting down seemed to be what the regents were going for. A lot of people during the meeting, the regents especially, and lawmakers also prior to the meeting, have pointed to the situations at UC Berkeley where conservative speakers and authors like Ann Coulter or Ben Shapiro have been shouted down and basically have had to leave under threat of being shouted down, and also potential violence. You know, we saw some rioting that happened after one of those speakers had to leave the campus. So that's what they're trying to avoid.
How did the vote shake out today?
The only person to vote against the resolution was Tony Evers. He's on the Board of Regents because he is also the head of the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Evers, by the way, is running, of course, for governor as a Democrat, hoping to unseat Governor Walker next year.
What did supporters have to say on the Board of Regents?
One of the best points I thought that was made in support of the resolution came from Regina Milner. She basically said that she said this is something that we've observed not just in Wisconsin but across the country. She says that they're just trying to avoid what's happening. They're trying to be proactive, trying to set some rules in place before anything gets out of hand in Wisconsin.
I don't consider drowning out another speaker as freedom of speech. I am a very strong supporter of freedom of speech, but that doesn't qualify.
And did we hear from students in support of this measure?
Yeah, it was interesting. As soon as the Board of Regents started to take up and started to discuss this resolution, one by one, students in the gallery started to stand up, and they had signs that they were holding that said "Vote No." A couple students had written "Vote Yes" on their notebooks, but among the students that were standing in silent protest was Derek Brown. He's a senior in entertainment design at UW Stout, and he basically told me after the meeting that he's worried that the resolution could have the opposite effect of what the people intended.
I think that the approval of this policy could potentially be used as a vehicle, if not a flagrant invitation, to groups and individuals that have harmful speech to the UW system. And I thought it was very unfortunate to see it passed.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire. Go ahead, Rich.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Rob. But I was just going to follow up and say that Derek told me that when he talked about harmful speech, he meant hate speech. He thought that this might be actually opening the door to really extreme groups coming on campus and trying to incite some kind of trouble. I guess we'll have to see if that plays out.
And you mentioned there were also students holding signs that said yes to this vote. What did you hear from them?
Well, I spoke with Josh Bergman. He's a senior at UW Stout in applied math and computer science. And he told me that he believes that conservative voices are absolutely discriminated against on campuses. Maybe not so much at UW-Stout, but he pointed to an example, I believe it was in November, down at UW-Madison, where Ben Shapiro, who is a conservative author and also former editor of Breitbart.com, was interrupted for about 7 minutes during a speech there. So he doesn't want to, he thinks that this is going to help protect, give equal weight to conservative voices as well.
This happened to the exact same speaker at UW-Madison, like within the last year, where students were inside when he was trying to give a speech and shouting him down, and the police could not do anything because they were told if they shut down the protesters that they would have to shut down the entire event, which is completely ridiculous.
So now this is passed by the Regents, Rich. What happens next with implementing this rule?
Well, it goes to the chancellors, basically. At this point, I'm not positive on when the rule takes effect. I know with legislation, it has to be published in the state journal. But with regards to this, the next step is chancellors having to decide whether or not there have been violations of this new rule. And the chancellors then, well, they don't necessarily have to expel students, but if they do not, they do have to report one way or the other back to the Board of Regents on the decisions that they've made on this. So it really puts the emphasis on them now.
And this is something that regents and chancellors have been hearing about from state lawmakers, and there were attempts to put this into legislation instead of action by the regents. What have we heard from lawmakers on this?
Well, Jesse Kramer, he's a Republican from Keewaskum, I believe, and he introduced legislation in the Assembly that basically directed the Board of Regents to come up with some rules. That legislation hasn't really gone anywhere, and I haven't found out yet if he can. I wouldn't imagine that he would pursue that because he basically got what he was asking for. But I'm sure lawmakers will be watching to see how this plays out and whether it's followed through at the campuses.
Now, this was the high-profile item at the Regents meeting this week. The Regents also voted on things related to how they recruit and hire chancellors, the head honchos at the different campuses. What happened there?
Well, there were some changes regarding, first of all, the committee. People might not know, but search and screen committees are a routine on campuses, and the search and screen committees used to be very large, and this is for chancellors. They could be upwards of 20-some people and made up of faculty, staff, students, community members, alumni. The resolution that was passed yesterday by the Board of Regents cuts that down to 10 members on these special committees, and half of which will be regents. It's not unusual for regents to be on search and screen committees prior, but now half of them would be regents, which are political appointees for the most part. The other members on the committee would be from the university.
So that sounds like it puts the balance of power more in the favor of regents to hire a chancellor, I mean, just based on the math there?
It seems that way. It's definitely a seismic shift, I would say, in how these committees are composed. I spoke with UW-Stout Chancellor Bob Meyer yesterday, and he said that the universities are going to have to be extra careful in deciding who they pick to represent the university when they search for future chancellors.
And then qualifications have changed, too. It sounds like it would be easier to hire somebody from outside of the academic world.
Yeah, that has been kind of the idea, is to open the doors to people from the private sector. Regent John Bailing, who's the regent president, said that this is a goal. And he basically said that the resolution prohibits campuses from requiring a doctorate degree or having tenure at a university. So the idea is to make it easier for people without academic backgrounds to head these universities. And they said that part of the reason for that is that the role of chancellors has changed a lot recently. Now, John Bailing said that 30-40% of a regent's of a chancellor's responsibility is now fundraising. So they say the role has changed. It's time to change, the qualifications required.
And are there any other issues that are falling under the radar that came out of this meeting, Rich?
Those are the two big attention getters. I mean, they also, you know, there was the naming of a building at UW-Stout. There were some basically some routine matters that were discussed today too regarding different budgetary things, but everyone was waiting for the freedom of expression, to be honest.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Rich Kramer, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about the UW Board of Regents meeting at UW-Stout, where leaders voted on a campus free speech policy. Now, the Las Vegas mass shooting targeted a country music festival, and since the tragic event, some country music artists are raising questions about gun control. The artists Florida Georgia Line and Thomas Rhett were withdrawn from an NRA country webpage. Roseanne Cash reiterated her support for gun control. And Caleb Keeter, guitarist for the Josh Abbott Band, which played at that festival, publicly reversed his opinion on gun control. Our next guest says country music performers have a lot of influence potentially in the gun control conversation. Chris Richards is a pop music critic at The Washington Post. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you wrote about the connections between country music performers and NRA, especially this NRA country webpage. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think a lot of people might think, you know, to say that American gun culture and country music are connected, that would be a stereotype. But in fact, the National Rifle Association and the country industry are officially connected through this sub-initiative called NRA Country, which basically allows country musicians to lend their star power to the American gun lobby. And it's not just, you know, fringe stars. It's a lot of really big names, including Lee Bryce, Luke Combs, John Party. And then since Sunday's shooting in Las Vegas, as you just mentioned, there are two huge names who have withdrawn their participation in this program, Thomas Rhett and the duo Florida Georgia Line. These are arguably probably the two biggest names who are aligned with NRA Country before what happened in Las Vegas. And they're leaving the group, I think, signals something big.
And you mentioned, you know, it might be seen as a stereotype, but people may associate it with a country music lifestyle and guns for people who think of them as positive and part of life wouldn't see that as a negative stereotype necessarily.
And that's kind of what NRA Country is all about. They're one of the organizers behind it back in 2010 said that it was designed to present, quote, a softer side of the National Rifle Association. So very much trying to use the wholesome image of country music to match the wholesome image of gun ownership that they're trying to promote.
Now, we mentioned guitarist Caleb Keeter. He was there at that festival. Afterward, he had a written announcement. I'll quote a couple lines from it. I've been a proponent of the Second Amendment my entire life. Until the events of last night, I cannot express how wrong I was. And then later in the same statement, we need gun control right now, in caps there. My biggest regret is that I stubbornly didn't realize it until my brothers on the road and myself were threatened by it. We are unbelievably fortunate not to be among the number of victims killed or seriously wounded by this maniac. That statement from guitarist Caleb Keeter there. This is pretty dramatic, and this got a lot of attention after it came out, Chris.
Incredibly dramatic, and I don't mean to undermine the sentiment or the importance of it, but it should also be noted that Keeter is a side musician in the Josh Abbott Band. He's not like the brand name,
right,
so to speak, the name on the marquee, and we've yet to see that kind of exclamation coming from a larger star, aside from Roseanne Cash's editorial, which I'm sure we're going to talk about during this conversation. But I hope that it's the kind of thing that puts an idea in people's heads and that gets this conversation moving.
And let's talk about Roseanne Cash.
Yeah.
She has been known for her position on gun control. This isn't something that's new for her.
That's true. And she had an op-ed that ran in the New York Times a couple of days after the shooting, which she urged country artists to speak out against the NRA. She wrote, quote, "Some people may burn your records or ask for refunds for tickets to your concerts. Whatever. Find the strength of moral conviction, even if it comes with a price tag, which it will. Don't let them bully you into silence." Those are very strong words from Roseanne Cash. And the reason she had to say those is because a lot of times in Nashville, country musicians are incredibly reticent to take a political stand. So much of how the machinery works in country music is about gaining fans, gaining listenership, and not alienating anybody, not making anybody feel uncomfortable. So historically, country superstars have been very, very reticent to talk politics, and I think Roseanne Cash is trying to disabuse a lot of her fellow artists of that notion.
That could be an issue in any industry, but can you talk about past examples of country artists who might have taken a stand at odds with at least what's perceived as the views of their fan base?
Sure. Well, the big one, of course, that we you know I'm going to say right now is the Dixie Chicks. Back in 2003, they played a show overseas and expressed their disappointment with then-President George W. Bush. The conservative backlash to these statements was just sweeping and complete in an instant. And essentially, the Dixie Chicks, who were a colossal act at the time, one of the biggest names in the business, were effectively silenced. They were taken off of, boycotted from country radio, from sea to shining sea, and we stopped hearing the Dixie Chicks on the radio in America. I think this has put a tremendous fear in country artists. They know that there's that the radio programmers have a huge power over their fate commercially and artistically, and that it's made them reticent to step up and say something.
Talking to Chris Richards, music critic at the Washington Post, looking at the role of country music performers in the conversation about guns and gun control, especially after the mass shooting targeting a country music festival. And Chris, what kind of difference, what kind of influence can country musicians have on either side of the gun debate?
Well, I think that country music is probably more politically diverse than we're led to believe, so to speak. I think there are country artists who are probably on both sides of the gun control debate that we're not hearing from all of them, and I'm hoping that that changes. Country music is about, you know, essentially steeped in this idea of American truth-telling, you know, talking about what's really happening, what's really on our minds. I don't know why politics is kept out of that. You know, obviously our country is having a huge debate about, does politics belong in the NFL? Does politics belong here and there? I think country music, it absolutely belongs, because country music's central proposition is to tell the truth. And the connections to gun culture are real. This NRA country initiative that we're talking about, there's no NRA hip-hop, there's no NRA, you know, bluegrass, NRA jazz. It's NRA country. And the National Rifle Association knows that they have a huge audience in the country music audience, and they want to be there. So country musicians, this is a chance for them to sort of search their souls and decide where they stand on this and hopefully get a conversation going.
A lot of times with the NFL or pop music or anything, there will be some people out there who may not even feel strongly about one side of an issue or another, but say, hey, this is where I go to get away from the politics stuff. I want, you know, I don't mind a country song that's a little escapist, or just watching a football game, or an escapist novel, or whatever the pop culture entertainment is. Is there a case to be made for, hey, let's just play the songs and leave the arguing to somebody else?
I personally, as a critic, would disagree with that idea, also because the game is going to get played. You know what I mean? The songs that are not about politics are going to get played on the radio anyway. I don't think adding politics to make it part of our recreational time is a bad thing. That's where I'm coming from as a music critic. I think that politics is life, the line that we've put between politics and our everyday lives. We're starting to realize that maybe it doesn't actually exist. If country music can tell that truth, then we're really going to be listening to some real, real country music, I'd say.
People look at Hollywood in particular, and while there are exceptions, look at definitely a liberal industry there, and people make that joke about the Barbara Streisand effect, where she'll strongly endorse a candidate and then they lose. Does a celebrity endorsing a candidate or an issue really make a difference in the end?
It's hard for me to say that. I'm not a political pollster, sure, but I do think that I know our culture and our music should reflect the conversations that are really happening in the community. And this country is going to have a discussion. This nation, the United States, is going to have a discussion about gun control. We're going to continue to. And country musicians have a really good opportunity to get in and be a part of that conversation in a really productive way. On both sides of the issue, perhaps. But I would like to see people talking about it and not pretending that this isn't happening, and we can keep moving on.
I want to talk about an act like Florida Georgia Line. I mean, they're a country act. They've had a big crossover appeal. They show up on the New Year's Eve shows along with Taylor Swift and a lot of the biggest pop music stars out there. Do you see that as maybe one of the bands that people would look to, especially with them now not being on that NRA country website?
I do wonder. I mean, it should be noted that both Florida Georgia Line and Thomas Rhett, why they withdrew from participation with NRA country, they didn't do it with much fanfare. They didn't make big announcements about it. They just quietly were not on the website a few days after this shooting. So I think Nashville is probably scurrying to figure out how they want to handle this. I know that the other thing about the country music industry is it's very cozy. You know what I mean? A lot of these artists work very closely together. They're touring together all summer. The industry is a very intimate one. So that's the other opportunity here, is artists can decide that maybe they could form, even if they, I don't, this is me wishing something to happen, but, you know, maybe they could form an alliance together. If everyone's afraid of being boycotted the way the Dixie Chicks were, maybe if 20 artists held hands and said, hey, we're all going to say how we feel about this issue, they could do it. This, of course, is just my, from a pop critic's perspective, sort of daydreaming about the possibilities of what could happen. But, you know, it's me trying to uphold what the central premise of country music is, which is to tell the truth. So can Florida Georgia Line influence people? Absolutely.
Given that intimacy in the industry, apart from the political response there, what do you make of the response to this tragedy that affected so many performers, fans, friends in this shooting?
Sure. Well, we, you know, of course, there have been non-political response to this tragedy in country music, a huge one. Eric Church wrote a song that he performed at the Grand Ole Opry the other night, which will bring you to tears before he gets finished with the first verse, and I highly recommend people check it out. It's not a political song whatsoever. It's about him mourning this tremendous loss. This will be a huge, this is obviously a huge loss for country music. The thing, that's this idea that country stars think of their fans as family, I don't think that's, you know, some kind of commercial ploy that they use to get people to buy their albums. I think it's really, really real. So this strikes incredibly close to home for country music. And again, it just seems to me like if everyone has such intense feelings about this, it's an opportunity to try and do something about it, to try and have a positive change, to make a positive change.
As we wrap up, Chris, I mean, who are you really watching to see what they say and do?
I think there are a lot of progressive voices in country music. Brad Paisley has been one of them, Tim McGraw and Faith Hill, Maren Morris, Sam Hunt. These are artists who have spoken their mind a little more than usual in terms of politics. And I hope that rather than thinking and praying, maybe these artists will want to step up and try to speak up to help protect the everyday American lives that they're singing about.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Chris Richards, pop music critic at The Washington Post, looking at the response in the country music community, political and otherwise, to the shootings at a country music festival in Las Vegas. First, have you ever thought about what scientific things are going on when you plop a couple steaks on the grill? Have you ever wondered why certain cuts of meat taste better and cook differently than others? Our next guest may have some answers for us. Dr. Stuart Faramond joins us now. He's a food scientist, and his new book is called The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. Dr. Stu, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into the world of food science?
I have quite a unique story, I would say. I was originally a medical doctor. About 10 years ago, and I was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the time, and that forced me to leave medicine. So I then went into, it's a malignant brain tumor, and it was completely removed with the operation. It left me with epilepsy, which meant that I couldn't go back to medicine because there was a danger of me having seizures whilst I was working. So I left the medical profession, went into teaching. And then from teaching went into freelance science writing and science communication, and kind of fell into food research and food science. And so I guess nearly a decade on, I've got around to writing a book.
And your book covers the science of a lot of different kinds of food. We're going to talk about meat in particular today, but talk about just how much science can go into how we cook and how we can make better food.
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge, Rob. I think we do cooking a disservice when we just pick up a recipe book and follow it, because before our eyes, when we're getting something ready to eat, there's some incredible things going on, and it's not just an academic thing of, oh, isn't it nice to know that there's chemical reactions going on, or why when I beat this egg white it turns into this kind of this fluffy white meringue thing. But if you understand it, you can actually cook better, and you realize that a lot of things that you read about in the cookery books and you see that TV chefs do aren't actually always that right. So it's a kind of, it's a really empowering thing, and it also will give you ideas to be more creative and try new stuff.
You mentioned chemical reactions in cooking, and that takes us to meat and this thing. I've heard of it before. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Maillard reaction.
Yeah, you can say it however you want to say it.
How should I say it, though?
Tomato. I'm not, Maillard reaction, M-A-L-L. M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, Maillard reaction. It's the thing that gives meat its flavor. It's also called the browning reaction, Although if you just call it the Browning reaction, it does it a disservice, because it's not just about turning something brown. It's about giving flavor. If you cook something, when you cook meat, say you put it on a grill or something, and it gets that brown kind of crust going on, that's the Maillard reaction taking place. And it happens between about 218 and 320 degrees Fahrenheit. And what's happening is the proteins that are in the meat itself, they're breaking down and they're reacting with sugars. There's molecules of sugar within every single cell, and they react. And these two things, which are quite tasteless, come together to react to these countless different ways, and you get all these flavors come out. You get meaty, kind of caramelly flavors, nutty flavors. The reason why caramel tastes like caramel is because of the Maillard reaction. So you need to harness the Maillard reaction if you want your meat to taste like meat.
And we don't want to undercook meat, because that's hazardous. We hit that sweet spot with the Maillard reaction. My curse is the overcooking of meat. What happens to that delicious flavor when we let it cook too hot or too long?
Well, you can obviously have a steak that's rare in the middle. The main thing is that you get the outside seared so that you get that meatiness on the outside. And if you like, if you've got a tender cut of meat and you want it to be served rare or medium rare, then that's okay, because you're getting that very smooth texture on the inside. So you definitely want the outside seared. But when you're overcooking it, the thing you've got to bear in mind is that the meat, and most of it, the cuts that we buy is muscle, but that is 75 to 85% water. So it's essentially a big bag of water that's just kind of held together. And so when you're cooking, you want to preserve as much of that moisture as possible. But obviously, the longer you cook it, the more of that moisture that you lose. And even if you cook it in water, then it will still dry out, because what's happening is muscle is made up of millions and millions of hair thickness strands of these muscle fibers. They're individual cells and they've got water in them, but as you cook it, they shrivel up, and that water gets kind of squeezed out, a bit like if you've got a sponge and it's got water in it and you squeeze it and all the water comes out. So when you overcook it, you've essentially caused it to shrivel up, all those cells to kind of shrivel up together, all the moisture comes out, and you end up with this kind of bland, tasteless hunk of leather left over.
And Dr. Stu, you write about how to recover that hunk of leather. Is there anything we could do to save that overcooked meat?
Well, it's a bit like if you've added too much salt to a dish. You can't really undo it, but you can do things to kind of make the best of a bad situation. So the one time when we do overcook meat is when we're doing slow cooking, if we're doing stews or casseroles. And we do that with the chewy cuts of meat, kind of like your chuck and your things like that. And that's because they've got lots of a thing called connective tissue in. Meat itself, you've got the muscle, you've got the fat, and then you've got this thing called connective tissue, which is the white stringy stuff that you get going through it. And that's really difficult to chew. It's really difficult to digest. But if you cook meat slowly, then that connective tissue breaks down into a thing called gelatin, which is the same thing that makes jello wobbly and set. And that gives slow cooked meat this kind of this unctuous, velvety kind of flavor, kind of mouthfeel. And so what you want to do is, if you've got a lean cut of meat and you've overcooked it and it's gone dry, if it's turkey or chicken or whatever it is, then you want to try and recreate that kind of that luscious gelatin flavor. And so one way to do it is to shred up your meat and put it into a rich gravy, a rich sauce. If you make it into like a fritter, for example, then you get lots of flavorful things in there, lots of fats and oils in there. You can restore some of that smooth mouthfeel. So you want to get the dryness, split it up, shred it up, maybe put it into meatballs or something, so that you're kind of restoring some of this natural kind of the moisture that was there originally.
Talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. His new book is The Science of Cooking. We're focusing on meat today. Let's talk marinades now. I've been getting into marinades for chicken and pork chops and things like that. and I keep shooting for as long as I possibly can. I feel bad if I only marinate for half an hour. I'm an idiot. I don't need to marinate it that long, it sounds like, reading your book.
No, Rob, you're doing the right thing. The time shy person is coming up with the best marinades. the word marinade, it originally just meant like a salty soup that you used to preserve meat in. And somehow over the years, it's got turned into this thing that we put on meat and we leave it for a long time, and somehow the flavors infuse all the way through it. But it doesn't actually happen. If you can do experiments, you can get meat and you can submerge it in something. And the liquid, the flavor-filled liquid that you're putting it in, what's your favorite marinade, Rob?
I've come up with this chicken shawarma marinade. I grind cumin and things like that. I'm talking about it all the time. I love this. And it comes out good when I marinate it.
Well, essentially, when you marinate, you're putting a glaze on the outside of the meat because that marinade can't get very far into the muscle. As I said, muscle is the meat is 75% to 85% water, so it's like a filled sponge. You can't actually get much more in there. So when you're soaking it in this marinade, it's only going in a few millimeters. So you can leave it in your marinade, leave it overnight, leave it 2 days. It's still never going to get right into the middle. And the danger of leaving it more than a few hours is that the acids that are in your marinade, if you've kind of used some vinegar or some lemon juice or some wine or something like that, they're actually starting to break down the surface meat. So it's going to make it kind of go mealy. It's the same thing that if you ever cook fish ceviche, when you get fish and you slice it up really raw fish, slice it up really fine, and you put it in some lemon juice, and it actually comes out kind of cooked tasting. That's because acids will cook meat in the same way it does if we were to heat it.
And I wanted to ask you right about a question that I think everybody has. Why do so many things taste like chicken?
Well, there's kind of two reasons behind this. One is the type of muscle that you got with chicken. Normally with chicken, we're thinking of the chicken breast, which is this pale muscle. And that has got, it's called a fast twitch muscle in that it's designed for doing short bursts of activity. So it's the breast muscle. So normally a chicken would be using it to flap its wings. And that kind of muscle doesn't have much red coloring, doesn't have much of a thing called myoglobin, which is what makes meat red. So it doesn't have much flavor from that point of view. It doesn't have much of the flavor-carrying fat. And so essentially, it's quite a bland muscle. So essentially, it's bland. So other bland-tasting meats that are like that, like frog, for example, or pigeon or something like that, it'll taste quite similar because there's not much to distinguish it from other muscles, whereas, say, beef and lamb, they're a different kind of muscle. They're these endurance muscles, and they have a lot more flavor and a lot more character than. But interestingly, scientists have tracked back using genetics to try and work out where the different animals came from. And it seems that most of the animals that we eat came from a now extinct ancestor, which tasted a lot like chicken. So dinosaurs tasted like chicken.
Wow. Like, that makes you think. If only we could try them. We're talking about the science of cooking meat with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the science of cooking with meat? What is your go-to cut of meat? Do you have any sciencey food questions for Dr. Stu? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe get your questions coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Stuart Faramond, food scientist and the author of The Science of Cooking. We are focusing on meat. His book covers a lot more than meat. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have questions about cooking with meat that science could answer for you? Have you ever wondered what's actually happening to your food when you cook it? Call in with your questions and maybe your ideas. See if they work out or not scientifically. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Philip on the line in Stevens Point. Philip, hi.
Hi, my question is about intentionally aging meat, sometimes to the point where it looks like it may be rotten. I've heard it increases the flavor, it's a desirable thing.
Philip, thanks. Dr. Stu, aging meat?
Well worth doing, really well worth doing. And yes, it will go brown on the outside, and yes, you will get some mold in it quite possibly, but it's something that's doing something that's well worth doing if you want to get flavor out of your meat. Because what's happening is when you age meat, you're letting enzymes within the meat itself do some of the digesting for you. It will be breaking down the muscle and making it more tender. You can kind of think of it that muscle, when it's alive, it's doing a lot of stuff. It's going through a lot of stress, and it's having to repair itself the whole time. And a part of that repairing process is that there are enzymes in the muscle that break it down so that it can be rebuilt again. But when the animal is dead, they obviously can't be rebuilt, but those enzymes that do the breaking down are still in there. So if you let the meat rest, those enzymes will do some of the breaking down, and after about 14 days, it will be at 80% maximum tenderness. So that's a really good time to leave it for. If you can leave it for longer, that's even better. The trick is to make sure you've got a big bit of meat, because it's going to dry out. Put it in the fridge. Make sure put a drip tray underneath it and put some water in that drip tray, and essentially just leave it in there. The water in the drip tray, some of that will evaporate, and that will increase the humidity within your fridge, and so that will stop it drying out a bit. And so go back periodically and check on it, and if there's kind of there's crusts and there's bits of mold on the outside, that's okay, that's normal. When you come to finish, you just want to chop that off, and then the meat inside, it'll still be red inside, it'll be brown on the outside, but it'll be red on the inside, and you have really tender, really beautiful meat on the inside.
I don't know, man, I'm getting a little nervous about meat in my fridge after day 4, maybe. How do I know for sure that this meat is just aged and not, you know, hitting rancid / lethal stage?
That's a really, I would say get your meat from a good quality butcher, so that you know the meat's been handled well, and so you're not going to have lots of nasty pathogens on the outside if it's been kind of thrown around some kind of packaging plant before it was slapped in some cellophane. But it's and so that's good, so that you're not going to have super nasties on the outside. But essentially, if you've got good quality meat and you put it in your fridge, it should be fine. All if right. You've got any questions, find a friendly butcher and ask them about how they age their meat. They're great people to talk to for finding out tips on aging meat. But give it a go. Give it a go. Make sure you've got a big bit. Don't do it with a steak or something, because it will shrivel up and the moldy bits will end up being more than the meat that's left over, and you'll be really disappointed. So get a big bit of meat. Don't be worrying about that you're going to have to shear off some of the outside, because what's left on the inside will be really good.
Philip, thanks. Hope that helps you out. We'll go next to Daryl on the line in Hayward. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
My question is regarding steak tartare. I'd like him to comment on that, because that's raw ground sirloin on dark rye bread. What does he have to say about that?
Daryl, thanks. This is big in certain subcultures in Wisconsin, Dr. Stu. Steak tartare, what do you think?
Hey, Daryl. Yeah, Daryl, I love steak tartare. It's really nice. If you're kind of worried from a sort of a health and safety point of view,
and
then steak is... Then you are. Are you worried, Rob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's safe. It's fine. It is fine. The thing that I mean, we know, we're told that raw meat is dangerous. But the thing is that the inside of the meat is fine. It's only the outside of the meat that's been exposed to the air and that's got all the bugs on it that is the dangerous bit. When you get to the inside of the meat, that's going to be essentially perfectly sterile. So providing you're not, so if you're using the middle of the meat and you're eating it raw, then it should be absolutely fine. You should always use your senses. So if, our senses are highly attuned, highly evolved to be able to pick up when something isn't right. If it tastes bitter, then that means that there's something in there. There's maybe some toxins or something in there that bugs happen to have been crawling on it. Don't eat it if it's sticky or slimy or if it doesn't smell good. But if it's, if none of those things, it should be perfectly fine.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the science of cooking with meat, and we're talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. His new book is called The Science of Cooking. He covers a lot of kinds of cooking. We're focusing on the meat chapter today. You also write about different kinds of chicken. And when you're at the store, you might see all kinds of different labels on chicken: organic, free range, indoor, outdoor. Does it matter what we buy in terms of what it's going to taste like?
One thing I must say about the raw meat thing is that whereas steaks can be served rare, if your hamburgers are less safe, because hamburgers are made from mince, and so that mince has all been exposed to the air, and so when you're pounding all together, you're essentially got potentially all the outside bits of meat all mushed up on the inside. So you've got to be more cautious with hamburgers, but essentially what I said before holds true. Chicken, yes, they'll try and sell as anything, won't they? Happy chicken, corn-fed chicken. If you can taste the difference, you're doing well, I'll be honest with you, because I've tried very expensive chicken and cheap chicken, and it's hard to tell the difference apart. But there are differences, there are subtle differences. One thing to bear in mind is that the chickens that we'll eat from today, they're broiler chickens. They're kind of a hybrid bird that has never existed in the wild. And we've bred them and we've bred them so that they're bigger and bigger and bigger. And they produce loads of meat, but it's quite tasteless. The only way if you're going to have really flavorful chicken is to actually go to a heritage breed chicken, one that is actually smaller. They have to live longer before they're killed, because they're slower growing. 50 years ago, the chickens that we were eating then were a quarter of the size of the chickens that we have now. That's how far it's gone. So I would say the breed of the chicken is probably going to be the biggest influence on the flavor that you're going to have from the chicken. But it's quite hard to get hold of a heritage breed chicken, and it's going to cost you a small fortune if you do find it. So short of that, you want to go for the best living conditions possible for your chicken. So stuff that is organic, that's the best marker that you've probably got, if you're going down the supermarket, to know whether the chicken has had a good life or not. Because any animal that is stressed or has had a poor life, the meat will be inferior. Organic means that it's had more area to live in. It has access to the outside. They should be down to about 5 chickens per square meter. Whereas if you go for your indoor farmed chicken, which will just be everything that doesn't say otherwise on the packet, then they will put up to 20 chickens in a square meter. That's how they live. It's quite... you just have to go onto YouTube and look at the videos to see how unpleasant it is. So I would say go for the best welfare possible. You'll see also corn-fed chicken. Now, that just means that they've been fed corn and they have a slightly different flavor, and the color of the meat will be slightly more yellow, but it doesn't mean anything about how well it's been kept. So corn-fed could mean that it's been reared in inhumane conditions, but it's just been fed corn. So I would go for welfare secondary to going for a heritage breed if you can get hold of one.
Well, Dr. Stu, we've just scratched the surface. I hope we can talk to you again before too long. Thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure, Rob.
We've been talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the new book, The Science of Cooking: Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We've been focusing here on the science of cooking meat. His book covers a lot more ground than that. There's a lot of veggies and potatoes and starches in there, too. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your favorite recipes or cooking tips while you're there. Again, that's over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's the end of an era for computer users of a certain age. AOL Instant Messenger will close down in just over 2 months after 20 years in operation. That announcement came out earlier today. Producer J. Carlisle Larson has memories, fond and otherwise. Hey, JC.
You know, this news today was kind of like a knife in the heart, if I can be a little hyperbolic. I mean, AOL Instant Messenger, I think, was such a big deal for, again, this is the second time this week that I'm going to out myself as a millennial, but this is how, I mean, this is pre-texting, really. So it was a quick way to communicate with your friends. For me, it was my first foray into flirting with people. So kind of safe in the confines of your house. But, you know, this is how we kind of hung out.
Right. And so this is, you went on, was it still a dial-up modem?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was slow. And so those interactions were slow, but they were so crucial for me as a tween to teen.
So whereas I would sit in the back room tying up the family corded phone for hours on end talking to fellow high school students, this is what you were doing.
This is what we did. We moved from phones to AOL Instant Messenger. So for people in my age range, I think it's a sad day of remembrance, even though I haven't used AIM in years.
Well, there's no way for the youth to communicate with each other online.
There's no more communication ever again.
Thanks, JC. Communicating with you, the only way we know how. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.